Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Danse Macabre by Stephen King, performed by William DeFries. What's Scary? By Stephen King. All my life I've been going to see scary movies, beginning with 1950s black and white monster fests like The Black Scorpion and Earth vs. the Flying Saucers, where the alien invaders look very much like the prawns in District 9. And although much has changed in my life since the days when it cost a quarter to get in and the butter on the popcorn was real, I find myself asking the same three questions. First, why do so many so-called horror movies, even those with big budgets, maybe especially those with big budgets, not work? Second, why do genre fans, such as myself, so often go in with high hopes and come out feeling unsatisfied, and worse, unscared? Third, and most important, why is it that others, sometimes those most unheralded others, with teensy budgets and unknown untried actors, do work, surprising us with terror and amazement? Oh, and here's a bonus question. Why do I care? What part of me feels driven to see another remake of The Hills Have Eyes? Not very good. Or The Last House on the Left? Brilliant. I'm 63 and my hair is graying. Shouldn't I have left all this childish crap behind? Apparently not. Hell, I don't even want to. In Danse Macabre, a book I wrote almost 30 years ago, I argued that people, attracted to stories about monsters and mayhem, are essentially pretty healthy, if sometimes morbid. Critics of the book, and there were quite a few, responded predictably, "Yeah, sure, what else are you gonna say, that you're all a bunch of sick canines?" Well, we probably are. But we also have an overload of imagination. Sometimes a blessing, sometimes, especially when it's late at night and you still can't sleep, a curse. One of the accessories you get when the Bureau of Genetics supersizes you in the imagination department is more worries than the average Joe or Jill has to deal with. So while Ma and Pa are downstairs watching American Idol, chowing on Doritos and worrying that their favorite warbler may get voted off the show, their over-imaginative little sunny boy or baby girl is upstairs listening to Slipknot and wondering if Doritos give you cancer. The imaginative person has a clearer fix on the fact of his/her fragility. The imaginative person realizes that anything can go disastrously wrong at any time. The imaginative person doesn't believe that serial killers only happen to other people. He or she understands that guys like Henry are actually out there, and running into one is a lot more likely than winning $350 million in the Powerball lottery. And there are a lot of other serial killers out there. They have names like cancer, stroke, or meeting a vodka-fueled alcoholic traveling southbound in the northbound lane of the turnpike. Your lane, at 110 miles an hour, fantasizing that his crappy little Honda Accord is the Millennium Falcon. In a case like that, decapitation and instant death might be the best-case scenario. Worst case, you wind up a quadriplegic pissing into a bag on your hip for 25 years or so. And the person with the supersize me imagination knows it. I'd argue that people whose entertainment needs can be satisfied with American Idol on the old Tubola, or a wild and crazy night out to watch the Corn Patch Players put on the Sound of Music, are afflicted with imaginative myopia. Those of us who feel more, and see in darker spectrums, may be sick puppies, but we're also lively puppies, brave puppies too, because we keep on trucking in the face of everything we know can go wrong. For us, horror movies are a safety valve. They are a kind of dreaming awake. And when a movie about ordinary people living ordinary lives skews off into some blood-soaked nightmare, we're able to let off the pressure that might otherwise build up until it blows us sky high like the boiler that explodes and tears apart the Overlook Hotel in The Shining. The book, I mean. In the movie, everything freezes solid. How dorky is that? We take refuge in make-believe terrors so the real ones don't overwhelm us, freezing us in place and making it impossible for us to function in our day-to-day lives. We go into the darkness of a movie theater hoping to dream badly, because the world of our normal lives looks ever so much better when the bad dream ends. If we keep this in mind, it becomes easier to understand why the good horror movies work, even if they do so, as is often the case, completely by accident, and why the hundreds of bad ones just don't. Expensive CGI effects, elaborate makeup jobs, and exploding blood bags won't scare anybody over the age of 14, 3 years younger than you have to be to get into an R-rated movie. The kids have seen it all before. It's boring. If a horror movie is going to work, there has to be something in it beyond splatter. Either by pure chance, Tobe Hooper's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, or by pure genius, Sam Raimi, Steven Spielberg, some filmmakers are able to reach that something. They grope into our subconscious minds, find the things so terrible we can't even articulate them, unless you've got the money and the inclination to spend 20 years or so on a psychiatrist's couch, that is, and allow us to confront them. Not directly, though. Few of us are able to look straight into the eyes of the Gorgon. Humans deal better with symbols. The cross equals Christianity. The swastika equals Nazism. Or Nazism, if you're Brad Pitt in Inglorious Bastards. A number 3 decal on the back window of your pickup says you still miss Dale Earnhardt. That being the case, the central thesis of Danse Macabre, written all those years ago, still holds true. A good horror story is one that functions on a symbolic level, using fictional and sometimes supernatural events to help us understand our own deepest real fears. And notice I said understand and not face. I think a person who needs help facing his or her fears is a person who isn't strictly sane. If I assume most horror readers are like me, and I do, then we're as sane or saner than those who read People, their daily newspapers, and a few blogs, and then call themselves good to go. My friends, a vicarious obsession with celebrities and a few dearly held political opinions is not a useful life of the imagination. That's the life of a beetle that just happens to have opposable thumbs and the ability to count to 10. I'm sure a lot of the so-called realists who run the world think we're cracked, pervo, and possibly ready to shoot up the local high school when they see us paying for a magazine with a decomposing monster on the cover, but that's their problem. I don't know about you, but as far as I'm concerned, everything's cool with the kid. I'm all for make love, not war, as long as I can have Jason and Freddy. The American Idol folks can collect all the Care Bears they want. I like my fear bears. Besides, how can you not love a genre where a movie, The Blair Witch Project, made for under $100,000, can scare the bejabbers out of the whole world and gross a mind-boggling $250 million? That's either pure democracy or pure anarchy. Pick the term you like best. I think they're both beautiful. Here is a case where the low-budget and unknown acting troupe became integral parts of the film's success. There's nothing hyped up and phony about Blair Witch, the way all the Saw movies after the original and Saw 2 are hyped up and phony, the cinematic equivalent of Thanksgiving Day parade floats. One thing about Blair Witch, the damn thing looks real. Another thing about Blair Witch, the damn thing feels real. And because it does, it's like the worst nightmare you ever had, the one you woke from gasping and crying with relief because you thought you were buried alive and it turned out the cat jumped up on your bed and went to sleep on your chest. Horror, like comedy, looks easy. In one, you throw a pie in someone's face and roll the camera. In the other, you throw blood in the person's face and roll it. Gotta work, right? Actually, wrong. Horror's not a delicate genre. There's nothing delicate or refined about movies where people turn into bubbling goo when some extraterrestrial plague starts eating them alive. But it's mysterious. What works one time That final hand from the grave scare and carry, for instance, often won't work again, at least until it does. What worked in a super low-budget flick like Blair Witch may not work on a higher budget. The sequel, Book of Shadows, for instance. I loved it, but I was pretty much alone on that one. Making a successful horror movie is like catching lightning in a bottle, and even the most talented filmmakers may only be able to do it once or twice. When Sam Raimi finally returned to his roots with Drag Me to Hell, he created a movie that's terrific fun, but not particularly scary. If you want scary, you have to go back to The Evil Dead, or Curse of the Demon, the British film that inspired Hell, and even that may be a wasted trip by now. A good horror movie is in many ways like a good joke. Revisit the punchline too many times, and it wears out. When you've been around horror movies a while, you become aware that the same themes and bogeymen come up again and again, and the bogeymen often wear the same hockey masks. This is partly because we have a tendency to return to what scares us. In real life, we call this need obsessive-compulsive disorder. And partly because, hey, let's face it, horror is the home turf of cinematic quick-buck artists and con men. Studios and indie producers have a tendency to greenlight the same idea over and over again, running the money-pressing machinery until every last buck has been squeezed out of it. The squeezing results in clear cycles that fans of the genre have seen again and again. Genius gives birth to genius perfected. Genius perfected gives birth to unenlightened imitation. Think of any direct-to-video haunted house flick or made-for-TV demon kid movie that ever bored you to death. Unenlightened imitation gives birth to comedy, after which the basic idea lies still for a time before coming back to life again, like a vampire in his coffin. Here are three specific examples, beginning with The Blair Witch Project. The first time I saw Blair Witch was in a hospital room about 12 days after a careless driver in a minivan smashed the shit out of me on a country road. I was, in a manner of speaking, the perfect viewer, roaring with pain from top to bottom, high on painkillers and looking at a poorly copied bootleg videotape on a portable TV. How did I get the bootleg? Never mind how I got it. Around the time, the three would-be filmmakers, Heather Donahue, Joshua Leonard, and Michael Williams, who coincidentally happened to be played by Heather Donahue, Joshua Leonard, and Michael Williams, start discovering strange Lovecraftian symbols hanging from the trees, I asked my son, who was watching with me, to turn the damn thing off. It may be the only time in my life when I quit a horror movie in the middle because I was too scared to go on. Some of it was the jerky quality of the footage, shot with a Hi-8 handheld and a 60mm shoulder mounted. Some of it was the dope, but basically I was just freaked out of my mind. Those didn't look like Hollywood location woods. They looked like an actual forest in which actual people could actually get lost. I thought then that Blair Witch was a work of troubling, accidental horror, and subsequent viewings, where I actually finished the film, haven't changed my mind. The situation is simplicity itself. The three kids, who start out making a documentary about a clearly bogus witch legend, get lost while making their movie. We know they are never going to get out. We're told on the title card, which opens the movie, that to date they have never been found. Only the jumpy, disconnected, haunting footage they shot remains. The idea is complete genius, and a big budget would have wrecked it. Shot on a shoestring, a ragged one, this docu-horror movie gained its punch not in spite of the fact that the actors hardly act at all, but because of it. We become increasingly terrified for these people. Even the annoying, over-controlling Heather, who never shuts up and continues to insist everything is totally okay, long after her two male companions and everybody in the audience knows it's not. Her final scene, an excruciating close-up where she takes responsibility as one tear lingers on the lashes of her right eye, packs a punch that few Hollywood films, even those made by great directors, can match. The fearless girl director, who confidently proclaimed, "I know exactly where we're going," has been replaced by a terrified woman on the brink of madness. And, sitting in a darkened tent after 6 nights in the woods, with the Hi-8 camcorder held up to her own face, we understand that she knows it. Blair Witch, it seems to me, is about madness. Because what is that really, except getting lost in the woods that exist even inside the sanest heads? The footage becomes increasingly jerky, the cuts weirder, the conversations increasingly disconnected from reality. As the movie nears the end of its short course, at just 80 minutes and change, is like a jury-rigged surface-to-surface missile loaded with dynamite, the video actually disappears for long stretches, just as rationality disappears from the mind of a man or a woman losing his/her grip on the real world. We are left with a mostly dark screen, panting elliptical lines of dialogue, some we can understand, some we can only guess at, noises from the woods that might or might not be made by human beings, and occasional blurry flashes of image, a tree trunk, a jutting branch, the side of a tent in a close-up so intense that the cloth looks like green skin.
"Hungry, cold, and hunted," Heather whispers. "I'm scared to close my eyes, and I'm scared to open them."
Watching her descent into irrationality, I felt the same. The movie climaxes when Heather and Michael find a decaying house deep in the woods. Shot almost completely in 16mm black and white at this point, the movie confronts us with a series of images that are simultaneously prosaic and almost too awful to bear. The wreckage inside seems to glare. Still carrying the camera, Heather bolts up the stairs. At this point, her two friends seem to be calling from everywhere, and the camera's randomly shifting eye flows past the handprints of the children who have almost certainly been murdered in this house. There's no dramatic music here or anywhere else. Blair Witch needs no such cinematic steroids. The only sounds are shuffling footsteps, yelling voices from everywhere, and Heather's escalating moans of terror. Finally, she plunges down to the basement, where one of the hokey stories they were told before their rash entry into the woods turns out not to be bullshit after all. Michael, or is it Josh, stands in the corner, dumbly waiting for the thing from the woods to do what it will. There is a thud as that unseen thing falls on Heather from behind. The camera drops, showing a blurred nothing. The film ends. And if you're like me, you watch the credits, trying to escape the terrified 10-year-old to whom you have been regressed. There have been fewer imitators of Blair Witch's documentary style than you might expect, given its absurd box office numbers. I believe that's because mainstream Hollywood moguls find something inherently offensive about amateurs playing with cameras, and they certainly don't want to look like amateurs themselves. In one Blair Witch sequence, you can hear a plane go droning overhead, and even though it works in the context of the film, I can't think of a single Hollywood producer who wouldn't tear his toupee off in the screening room when he heard it. Or how about the studio exec who wouldn't be able to restrain himself from saying, "These kids are nowhere. Can we replace them? Who's hot at Disney right now?" The mainstream faux docs I can think of, Cloverfield, Quarantine, the remake of The Spanish Wreck, Diary of the Dead, are all pretty good. But only George A. Romero's Diary approaches the purity of Blair Witch. Not until District 9 do we find genius perfected. It's not pure, if we take that to mean absolute adherence to the ideas of amateurs with cameras. And of course, D9's not a pure horror movie either, but the technique allows the film to achieve a sense of reality that's seldom seen in the old monsters from space genre. With its use of mixed media, documentary footage, fake news reports, even what looks like home movies, District 9 is closer to Orson Welles' radio version of War of the Worlds than it is to an entertaining but ultimately disposable big-budget flick like Independence Day. Even the D9 mothership feels real. Instead of an awe-inspiring, almost heavenly apparition like the mothership in Close Encounters, this baby looks like a stalled-out tractor-trailer rig that the driver, probably drunk, left in a no-parking zone. D9 is nothing like Blair Witch in terms of its subtext. Neil Blomkamp's film is about xenophobia rather than madness, but I'd argue that without Blair Witch, D9 wouldn't exist, at least not in its current form. And before leaving Blair Witch, I want to recommend Daniel Myrick's most recent film, The Objective. It isn't as successful as Blair Witch, but it's remarkably ambitious and has the same creepy vibe. The comedy horror doc hasn't come along yet, but I'm confident there are at least three in development. In any case, enough with the pagan symbols and crumbling houses hidden deep in the woods. Let's talk zombies. They've been around in the movies for a long time. I Walked with a Zombie, great title, not so great flick, came out in 1943. Macumba Love, a panting engine of sexuality featuring the large and delectable breasts of June Wilkinson, shambled into double bill theaters in 1960. Getting warmer, but still no genius. Romero's Night of the Living Dead followed in 1968. It was a groundbreaking horror movie for sure. Fans can tell you to this day where they were when they realized that Barbara's brother Johnny really was coming to get her. But the true genius was Romero's follow-up, Dawn of the Dead, with its uniquely American situation. Survivors of the original plague trapped in a mall surrounded by the living dead. The all-American shopper's heaven becomes a glittering chrome and plastic hell. The consumers become the consumed. Released in 1979, around the time that mall multiplexes were becoming not just common but de rigueur, it was the perfect fright film at the perfect time, and one of the few unrated movies to succeed commercially. Genius perfected would be Zack Snyder's 2004 Dawn remake, which begins with one of the best opening sequences of a horror film ever made. Anna, the gifted actress and director Sarah Polley, is relaxing in bed with her husband, Luis, when they are visited by the cute little skate girl who lives next door in their suburban Milwaukee development. When Luis goes to see what she wants, cute little skate girl tears his throat open, turning him into a zombie. And in the Snyder version, the zombies move fast. Romero never liked that part, but it works. Through a miracle of inspired editing, just when did she pick up those car keys, for instance? Anna is able to escape, first into a neighborhood that's become a slaughterhouse, and finally into the countryside, with a handy mall nearby. I'd argue that the most effective terror sequences are either the result of instinct or pure accident, rather than screenwriting or direction, and that's the case here. Polly is a Canadian actress whose face was largely unknown to American audiences in 2004. Her main claim to fame was getting fired by Disney after refusing to remove her peace sign necklace at an award ceremony when she was 12. You go with your bad self, Sarah. If we saw an actress like Julia Roberts or Charlize Theron as Anna, we'd know she's going to live. Because it's Polly, we root for her to escape, but we're not sure she will. Those first 9 minutes are a sonata of anxiety. The opening action ends with Anna crashing her car against a tree, and once again witness the miracles that can be accomplished in the editing room. The car runs at the tree on the driver's side, but in the next shot, hits dead center. The credits, which follow, set to Johnny Cash's The Man Comes Around, are accompanied by documentary and faux documentary footage. There's that Blair Witch influence again. That's supposed to show us the onset of the zombie plague. But the first shot shows something entirely different, and it's here that Snyder shows us exactly what this inspired remake is about, and how well he knew what was driving our fear engines at that particular point in time. What we see in that brief black-and-white shot is what looks like 1,000 devout Muslim worshippers bowing toward Mecca in unison, an image of mass belief that most Americans found troubling. By 2004, only 3 years downriver from 9/11, rampant consumerism was the last thing on our minds. What haunted our nightmares was the idea of suicide bombers driven by an unforgiving and unthinking, most of us believed, ideology and religious fervor. You could beat 'em or burn 'em, but they'd just keep coming, the news reports assured us. They would keep on coming until either we were dead or they were. The only way to stop them was a bullet in the head. Remind you of anything? And don't accuse me of racism or religious prejudice either. We're not talking about political, religious, or intellectual concepts here. We're talking about terror. And that's exactly what Snyder's zombies are, it seems to me. Fast-moving terrorists who never quit. You can't debate with them. You can't parley with them. You can't even threaten their homes and families with reprisals. All you can do is shoot them and then steer clear of the twitchers. Remember that their bite is worse than fatal.
Are they dead?
One of the mall survivors asks Steve, the repulsive rich guy. His response? Dead-ish. Man, that's scary. Yet some of the terror in Dawn transcends subtext and goes straight to the id. The movie's most frightening moment has nothing to do with politics. One of the mall survivors, Kenneth, played by Ving Rhames, has been communicating with another survivor, Andy, played by Bruce Bond, who is stranded on a nearby roof. They flash chess moves at each other on restaurant erase boards and note zombies who resemble celebrities. Andy, a dead shot, then picks them off. After being bitten by a ghoul, the dying, or already dead, Andy flashes one final sign. Not words, but a jagged smear of blood. In that single 3-second shot, Snyder tells us all we need to know about the insatiate hunger that lives in the decaying interior of an undead brain. In the end, the survivors, those who haven't been killed by zombies or each other, set sail on the loathsome Steve's booze cruise boat, heading for an unnamed island where they hope to find safety. The final credits suggest that hope is probably vain. It's not a cheery conclusion, but it didn't hurt the movie's grosses. Dawn dethroned Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ at the box office, suggesting that John Lennon was wrong. Zombies, not the Beatles, turned out to be more popular than Jesus. And that ending probably reflected the audience's deepest underlying fear. How can you escape terrorists who don't care about dying? There's no need for us to list the dozens of imitations. Comedy follows imitation as day follows night. Shaun of the Dead, brilliant. Black Sheep, amiably absurd, but in the last analysis, not up to much. And Zombieland, which I haven't seen at this writing. That one looks hopeful. I mean, hey, Woody Harrelson playing a stench-killing gunslinger named Tallahassee, you gotta like that. But I have my doubts. Partly because it looks like a slam dunk, mostly because I don't like seeing my beloved monsters dressed up in clown suits and made mock of. I like mine raw and mean and still bleeding. Which brings us to the best horror movie of the new century, Denis Iliadis's brilliant revisiting of The Last House on the Left. The engine driving this movie is the most powerful the genre has to offer, fear of the homicidal other. There have been hundreds, perhaps even thousands of these in the long history of the fright film, and most have the same underlying premise. You meet the homicidal other either as karmic retribution for doing something wrong, think of Janet Leigh in Psycho, who never would have been showering at the Bates Motel if she hadn't embezzled a bunch of money from the Phoenix business where she worked, or, this is worse, because you just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. There are very few homicidal other sequels that I care for. Saw 2 is one of the few exceptions to the rule, because they trade on a moral ambiguity that makes me uneasy. In A Nightmare on Elm Street, Freddy Krueger is flat-out evil. No question about it. We hate him and fear him from the get-go, and why not? He's a pedophile, a murderer, and a disfigured psycho from beyond the grave. But 7 sequels later, he has become, grotesque but true, a kind of pal. By the time Freddy vs. Jason rolled around in 2003, we were no longer expected to root for the nominal good guys, teenagers without an ounce of fat on them. What we were rooting for, as the sequels plodded on and on, was a high body count. These sequels are basically snuff movies. I go hoping to see something new and rarely find it. You can argue for Rob Zombie's excellent reimagining of Halloween if you wish to refute the point, but I'd note that Zombie's take on Michael Myers, an inspired collaboration for sure, isn't a sequel, but a remake. Which brings us back to the Eliadis version of Last House, the best horror redux in modern times. The Collingwood family, Emma, John, and daughter Mary, are on vacation at their lake house, which is marked by an ominously inverted sign reading, Lake Ends in the Road. Mary, played with courage and grace by Sarah Paxton, borrows the family car to go to town and visit her friend Paige, Marcia McIsaac, who works in the local grocery store. While they're talking, a young man named Justin, Spencer Treat Clark, tries to buy a pack of cigarettes with a blood-stained $20 bill. When Paige won't sell to him, he has no ID, Justin offers to trade them some good pot, which is back at the motel where he's staying with his family. It's this chance meeting that leads to the terrible events that follow, but it's also where Eliadis begins to spring the film surprises. Clark, whom some of you may remember as Silent Ray in Mystic River, gives a nuanced performance as the son of a homicidal maniac, Krug, played by Garrett Dillahunt. We identify his disturbing thousand-yard stare as the look of a dangerous psycho, but it's actually the numbed-out shock of an abused child who is more his father's victim than his son. Mary and Paige are taken captive by Krug, Krug's girlfriend, Sadie, Ricky Lindholm, and his brother Francis, Aaron Paul, of Breaking Bad fame. After a botched escape attempt by the girls, Paige is stabbed to death, Mary is raped, Krug does it himself after Justin refuses his father's invitation to go first and be a man, and then shot as she tries to swim across the lake to the house where her parents are awaiting her return. It's in this house that Krug and his devil's band seek shelter from a sudden summer storm. A coincidence, but a believable one, since Mary has purposely directed them toward it. So the homicidal others are given lodging for the night by the kindly parents of the very girl they have violated. Justin, who has taken Mary's necklace, leaves it where he knows the parents will find it. At roughly the same time Emma Collingwood spots it curled around the base of a coffee cup, she and John hear an irregular banging sound coming from outside. It's Mary, badly wounded, but still alive. In the original, she's killed after being raped. She has dragged herself from the lake and crawled up onto the porch and is pushing a rocking chair against the side of the house. What follows is a carnival of parental revenge. Mom half-drowns Francis in the kitchen sink, then stuffs his arm down the garbage disposal and turns it on. Sadie is shot to death in the bathroom. Krug has his head exploded in the microwave after the outraged surgeon father has paralyzed him from the neck down. This last touch is the film's only false move, partly because it's presented in a clumsy flashback as the family crosses the lake to safety, partly because it's the only place where Last House looks like just another horror movie, and partly because, damn it, you can't run a microwave with the door open. The 2009 Last House is the most brutal and uncompromising film to play American movie theater since Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, which didn't play many. The MPAA initially gave it an X rating, and it was finally released unrated. The murder of Paige and the rape of Mary in the woods are particularly excruciating, because there's a sense of filthy reality about these crimes that the depredations of Michael Myers and Jason Voorhees can't match. There's zero audience rooting going on for the bad guys here. When Mary finally loses the struggle to keep her plain cotton underwear on, and we know it's really going to happen, we are filled with rage and sorrow. And if there's an emotion more foreign to a Friday the 13th movie than sorrow, I don't know what it is. Our identification is all with the victim. These are bad people, and they deserve what's coming to them. What they do not deserve is a sequel where they become our buddies. The very effectiveness of some horror movies, the ones that show us the homicidal other with all his masks thrown aside, dooms them when they come before the critics. Owen Gleiberman of Entertainment Weekly, a magazine I write for on a tri-weekly basis, gave Last House an F rating. And this one, like Michael Haneke's jolting American remake of his German film Funny Games, took a predictably vigorous pasting. Only Roger Ebert seemed to partially get it, praising the performances. Dillahunt, he points out, isn't just acting scary, he creates a character.
but neglecting to note that great performances rise from stories where the motivations are believable and the things that happen have an air of inevitability. The original 1972 Last House on the Left, written and directed by Wes Craven, is so bad it rises to the level of absurdity. Call it Abbott and Costello Meet the Rapists. The bad guys are cartoons. The glare lighting is early American pornography. Mary's mom, in this version named Estelle and played by Cynthia Carr, looks suspiciously like Loretta Lynn, and the cops are a couple of bumbling stereotypes out of a 1940s dead-end kids comedy. The chainsaw climax, set in what appears to be a pine-paneled rumpus room, it may belong to one of the producers, is hilarious. The soundtrack is a wonder. This may be the only movie about rape, murder, and kidnapping to be set to a cheerful ricky-ticky public domain soundtrack. There's even a kazoo, a musical instrument I do not associate with terror. The one positive thing you could say about the original is that Craven must have had an extremely steep learning curve, because he started his career deep in negative territory. The Iliadis version is to the original what a mature artist's painting is to the drawing of a child who shows some gleams of talent. From the opening shot, a dream glide through the nighttime woods, the cinematography of Sharon Meyer is a work of beauty and a study in contrasts. From Krug's brutal murder of the cops, who were transporting him to prison, we jump to a serene underwater world where Mary floats beneath a cloud of silver exhaled bubbles. There is a similar ballet, a more nerve-wracking one, in the kitchen of the Collingwood cottage as Mary's mother makes subtle enticing advances toward the odious Francis, trying to get him to let his guard down enough for her to use a butcher knife on him. The analogous scene in the 1972 version, where Mama attempts to bite off the bad guy's dingus, is just grotesque. Worse, it's funny. I maintain that if the recent Last House hadn't come trailing the baggage of its infamous predecessor, and if it had been a foreign film that came equipped with subtitles, it would have been a critical success on the level of Repulsion, Diabolique, or An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, the short film by Robert Enrico that was telecast on CBS as a Twilight Zone episode. To some degree, Last House suffered from its own refusal to compromise, and I think it also paid a price for all its infamous predecessors, not just the original source material. But there's something else, too. Horror movies produce nerve music rather than head music. Because most critics, Ebert has always been an exception, tend to be creatures of the head rather than the heart, they can be amused, in a patronizing sort of way, by fright flicks that are too outlandish to be taken seriously. But they have a tendency to react with anger and outrage to the ones that operate successfully in the deep fathoms of primal fear. Last House, like Hitchcock's great film about the homicidal other, does exactly that. And, like the Iliadis film, Psycho was originally greeted with a chorus of largely negative reviews. Sadly, not many scare and splatter films are worthy of even such light analysis as I've given those I've addressed in this essay, but that doesn't mean there aren't others that are worth viewing or reviewing. Here are some others that have worked for me over the last 15 years or so. From Dusk Till Dawn, Robert Rodriguez's furious horror action picture, starring George Clooney and Quentin Tarantino. Although it was released in the mid-90s, Clooney and Tarantino play 70s-style bad guys who find themselves hiding out in a strip club populated by vampires. Twilight looks pretty thin compared to this. Scream. A knowing, funny, frightening send-up of the slasher genre, featuring a psycho and an Edvard Munch scream mask. Written by Kevin Williamson, Scream alternates laughs with authentic scares. Especially notable for the When a Stranger Calls riff that opens the movie. Not Drew Barrymore's finest hour, but certainly her finest horror hour. Mimic, Guillermo del Toro's first American film, and a work of brilliance and complexity. It plays on our fear of dark places, environmental mutation, science out of control, and killer insects can look like people. Perversely believable, with great effects and great performances by Charles S. Dutton and Mira Sorvino.
Event Horizon. Basically, a Lovecraftian terror tale in outer space with a creeping unknown vibe, done by the Brits. The plot's messy, but the visuals are stunning, and there's an authentic sense of horrors too great to comprehend, just beyond the eponymous, I always knew I'd eventually get to use that word, Event Horizon. Pi. Made on a shoestring by director Darren Aronofsky, this film about a theoretical mathematician descending into madness, he thinks he has found a 216-digit number that can somehow make him a fortune on the stock market, is a clear precursor of the Blair Witch Project. I left the theater not entirely sure of what I'd seen, but filled with feelings of deep unease. This one gets inside you. Bride of Chucky. Nah, just kidding. Deep Blue Sea. Directed by the ever-popular Rennie Harlan, who could probably turn Heidi into an action flick.
Give up the secret formula, or the goat dies.
This movie about genetically engineered sharks, you could say, isn't up to very much. Until, at the most unexpected point of the film, one of the Super Makos rears up and bites Samuel L. Jackson in half. Yes! I screamed out loud, and I treasure any horror movie that can make me do that. Stir of Echoes. Writer-director David Koepp should be declared a national treasure. His adaptation of Richard Matheson's 1958 novel is an unsettling exploration of what happens when an ordinary blue-collar guy, Kevin Bacon, starts to see ghosts, thanks to a hypnotic suggestion. Final Destination. I love all these movies, with their elaborate Rube Goldberg setups. It's like watching R-rated splatter versions of those old Roadrunner cartoons. But only the first is genuinely scary, with its grim insistence that you can't beat the Reaper. When your time is up, it's up. Jeepers Creepers. Victor Salva is a troubling erratic director with a troubling erratic history, including a conviction for sexual molestation of a child. But this tightly focused film about a brother and sister who run across a supernatural serial killer in northern Florida is relentlessly terrifying, playing as it does on our feelings of claustrophobia. The pipe scene is pure genius. If you haven't seen it, watch it. If you have, watch it again. But steer clear of the teenage spam on a bus sequel. It's for shit. The Mothman Prophecies. Richard Gere adds weight and unease to this story of a reporter trying to recover from the loss of his wife and trying to understand the strange drawings she made shortly before the tumor in her brain killed her. He is drawn to a West Virginia town where all sorts of strange phenomena have been reported, including sightings of an otherworldly being called the Mothman. Good, scary movies sometimes work on us like those ominous dreams from which we wake just before they can plunge us into full-out nightmares. Gere's character never actually meets the Mothman, which isn't such a bad thing. He, or it, is scarier in the shadows. This movie reminded me of Val Cat People Luton's best work. Eight-Legged Freaks. Not really so scary, but great fun. Giant spiders that run fast and kill everyone they can. The actors look like they're having as much fun as the audience. Probably should have been titled, It Came from the Drive-In. 28 Days Later. A furious and sometimes infuriating zombie film shot on digital video and Hey, Look at Me style by Denny Boyle. Most notable for its opening sequences in an eerily deserted London after clueless animal rights activists have loosed a living dead-type plague on the world. In its documentary feel, we can again see the influence of the Blair Witch Project. Shaun of the Dead. I know it's a send-up, but this Simon Pegg Edgar Wright gigglefest has a few genuinely frightening moments. A few good gross-outs, too. The best sequence combines humor and horror in a pleasantly disgusting souffle as Sean fails to notice the zombie uprising that has begun to happen all around him. We see it, but poor Sean just keeps missing the guy who gets bitten while he's mowing the lawn, etc., etc. Red Lights, Feu Rouge. In this French import, an alcoholic husband, Jean-Pierre Darroussin, and his long-suffering wife, Carole Bouquet, have a fight and split up while driving back from the summer camp where they left their kids. What follows on a darkened country road is a kind of double horror movie, as fascinating to watch as Spielberg's Duel. Saw. You know about this, but watch it again, and you'll see that it also works as a really superior mystery story. The same is true of Saw 2. The Jacket. Adrien Brody is terrific, those long-suffering eyes, in this story of a war veteran who becomes the subject of a mad doctor's experiments. He's locked in a morgue drawer and catapulted 15 years into the future. This movie has a remarkable chilly intensity and a sense of impending tragedy. Pan's Labyrinth. Ophelia's harsh reality, the Spanish Civil War, and her retreat into a fantasy world populated by fauns and monsters are perfectly blended in Del Toro's exceptional movie. Once you see it, you never forget the pale, eyeless creature, every kid's nightmare, that almost catches Ophelia and eats her before she's able to escape back, for a while anyway, into the real world. The Descent. If I were to pick another movie to analyze closely, it would be this remarkable story of six women who go on a caving expedition and encounter a race of subhumans who resemble Del Toro's Pale Man, now that I think about it. What gives the movie its resonance is how the women play against each other. Their very real resentments and secrets allow us to believe the monsters in a way that most horror movies do not. I never tire of saying this. In successful creep shows, it's not the effects and mostly not even the monsters that scare us. If we invest in the people, we invest in the movie and in our own essential decency. Snakes on a Plane. Just my opinion, but if you didn't love this movie, what the hell are you doing reading this? The Hitcher, 2007. Rutger Hauer in the original will never be topped. But this is that rarity, a reimagining that actually works. And Sean Bean is great in the role Hauer originated. Do we really need this film? No. But it's great to have it. And the existential theme of many great horror films, terrible things can happen to good people and at any time, has never been so clearly stated. 1408. John Cusack gives a bravura performance as a cynical debunker of the supernatural who discovers there really is an invisible world out there, one full of horrors beyond imagining. As a one-man depiction of madness, it stands alone, and Room 1408 in the fictional Dolphin Hotel is scarier than all the rooms of Stanley Kubrick's Overlook put together. In overlooking Cusack's performance, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences once more proved that great work is almost never rewarded, if it's done in a horror movie. Kathy Bates in Misery is the exception that proves the rule. The Mist. The ending will tear your heart out, but so will life in the end. Frank Darabont's vision of hell is completely uncompromising. If you want sweet, the Hollywood establishment will be pleased to serve you at the Cineplex, believe me, but if you want something that feels real, come here. Darabont could have made a higher budget film if he'd added a cheerful, "It's all okay, kiddies," ending, but he refused. His integrity and courage shine in every scene. Funny Games. Already discussed, but if you love the genre and haven't seen this, you should, for the simple reason that it turns the genre on its head. When things don't go according to the psycho bad guy's plans, one of them just, well, see for yourself. Suffice it to say that it outrages the rules of reality, and that's always a good thing. The Ruins. The Scott Smith scripted adaptation of his novel isn't quite as creepy as the book, but the sense of dismay and disquiet grows as the viewer begins to sense that no one's going to get away. With its cast of mostly unknowns, this would play well on a double Halloween bill with Snyder's Dawn remake. The Strangers. An orchestration of growing disquiet and horror as a young couple, Liv Tyler and Scott Speedman, are set upon by a trio of masked psychotics. It starts slowly and builds from unease to terror to horror. In the same class as Jeepers Creepers, but a little more existential. Why is this happening? Just because it is. Like cancer, stroke, or someone going the wrong way on the turnpike at 110 miles an hour. These may not be your favorites, because none of us have quite the same fear receptors. What I'm trying to say, and to show by example, is that cinematic horror is a potent art form, and there's a lot more going on under the surface than immediately meets the eye. Therein lies its many dark pleasures. And the next time your parents or your significant other asks you why you want to go and see that crap, tell them this: Stephen King sent me. He told me to look for the good ones because they're the ones that speak to what's good in the human heart. And, of course, to what isn't. Because those are the things you have to look out for.
It's easy enough, perhaps too easy, to memorialize the dead. This book is for six great writers of the macabre who are still alive: Robert Bloch, Jorge Luis Borges, Ray Bradbury, Frank Belknap Long, Donald Wandry, Manly Wade Wellman. Enter, stranger, at your risk. Here there be tigers. What was the worst thing you've ever done?
I won't tell you that,
but I'll tell you the worst thing that ever happened to me. The most dreadful thing. Peter Straub, Ghost Story.
Well, we'll really have a party, but we gotta post a guard outside.
Eddie Cochran, Come On Everybody.